Welcome back to The Firebreak. I'm Steve Wolf. As you know, The Firebreak is sponsored by Team Wildfire, developing innovative technology for fighting tomorrow's most destructive fires, which are actually with us today if you're living in many of those places. Today I've got Ralph Blomers with us. Ralph is the Director of Fire Safe Communities. He focuses on natural recovery. He's an amazing film producer, television producer. He's creating a lot of content that helps create awareness about what fires are, what they're doing, where they're heading, who's working on them, what we could do about them. Kind of, you know, the meat and potatoes of what we're all about here. So, Ralph, welcome to the Firebreak. How are you today?
I'm doing well, Steve. Thanks for having me.
You bet. You know, just before we started recording, Ralph was giving me a list of the cameras laying around his office that he's shooting with. I was getting serious camera envy there. What are you using all these cameras for, Ralph?
Well, you know, I would just go back to about 20 years ago, 22 years ago, my first experience in a fire-burned landscape was that I got a call from a whistleblower. And the whistleblower's job was to light fires, burn the understory, and only scorch the big trees. And he was upset because they were saying all the big trees that had fire scars them were dead and dying and therefore could be cut down. And these were old growth trees in eastern Oregon. And, you know, I went out there and I didn't think that there was going to be much for me to see, right? It was burned. It was destroyed. The fire was catastrophic, all that language that was coming out of the Bush administration at the time. And I was just really delighted to see the wildlife in this landscape, to learn that ponderosa pine trees have the technology that was borrowed and used on the space shuttle with their thick bark and how they diffuse heat and survive fire. In other words, they're fire-adapted landscapes with, you know, fire serotonous cones, and that there was all these critters that love that place. So what I started doing with my cameras was to try to unpack that that piece of one of the three or two of the three dominant cultural beliefs, which is that fire destroys the forest, fire kills all wildlife. But I knew that I couldn't get folks to read science articles and that they wanted to see it for themselves. So I started in the wake of some fires about 15 years later in the Columbia River Gorge doing wildlife and time-lapse photography. And I targeted, if you will, with my cameras, or set them up in the most severely burned areas that the media had told us all were destroyed.
Right, and it was what sterile, I found, nothing would ever grow there again, water wouldn't even seep into the soil. Right, we've all heard that, right?
Right, and you know, I mean, fire has been part of these landscapes since the retreat of the ice sheets in the Pleistocene, and the plants and animals have evolved with that force, both at low, moderate, and high intensity. And particularly in the Western Cascades where I live, where I first started setting up cameras, you're talking about rainforests that burn infrequently, and they burn in wind events, and they burn super hot. That's how they burn. And there's mosaics, right? There's killed parts. So like in this first fire, started the Eagle Creek fire in the Columbia River Gorge, the media said 50,000 acres was destroyed. And you went in there and 8,000 acres burned at high severity. But that wasn't destroyed. The landscape was still there. The dead trees were there, and live trees were even in there. And the understory just came back. You know, I like to think of it as like my teenager, right?
Yeah.
It's goofy and, you know, pushing out all directions and, you know, it's in like that. And it's
I've raised three boys. I get it, Ralph.
It's a young charcoal forest that's full of potential and getting tons of sunlight. And, you know, there's a lot of hope in that. And I think as people are wrestling with what's happening in the world around them, that what I've seen is that time-lapse in wildlife photography really connects with people, really addresses their anxiety, their what's called in the literature solastalgia, right? What are the changes in the world around us and how do we make sense of them? And it's been pretty amazing. You know, we incorporated it into the feature film that we made, Elemental Reimagined Wildfire. It has also led people in the wake of the 2020 Labor Day fire, which, you know, burned perimeters, I like to say, of over a million acres, right? Because within those areas were unburned.
Right.
But it burned down multiple communities, power line ignited fires in the 2020 Labor Day fires in Oregon. And I had people who had seen that work, who messaged me, who didn't know me, said, "I saw the things that you did. It made me feel so much better. Would you be willing to come with me when I go back to see if my house survived?" That
Wow.
is the depth of
Oh, wow. You're really.
where that connection for folks. And I, you know, and I guess, Steve, that's what I use my cameras for, and it's evolved now to storytelling, really about how we can all be fire safe people. How we, you know, instead of the message of only you, it's us and we and neighbor to neighbor. And it's definitely our actions can be enhanced by technology, but I'm big on we need more human intelligence on the landscape. Sure, artificial intelligence, sure, technology can assist us. But, you know, we need more collectively situational awareness. In other words, know what's going on, look for the signs,
Right.
right? Drought, wind, are the dominant factors in destructive fires. So now, you know, it's evolved from short form storytelling around what was happening in the forest to storytelling around how do we prevent community conflagration, structure to structure ignition, community loss. We were making the short form stuff and then paradise happened. I knew people that lost everything in the fire, lost their schools, lost their homes. And then we started on this feature filmmaking. And I think that really the core of it is approaching the viewer with respect, presenting them through the lens, A and B, so that they can equal see themselves. That fundamentally addresses the dominant negative cultural narratives around fire that lead us to these, as Jack Cohen would say, an improper problem definition. And so by doing that, it leads folks to a better problem definition and also empowers them to take action. And so that's a, you know, you could contrast that with other filmmaking. Maybe I will skewer a bit Michael Moore, right? But it's a little bit like, hey, you stupid person, you think this stupid thing, the world is messed up. And, you know, that kind of documentary filmmaking, which had its time and its place. And, you know, a film
Not helpful,
indicting,
though, right?
not really helpful. I mean, a film indicting things and indicting people is not really calibrated and suitable to the current time and
You're
space
not
that we're
making
in.
super fire me.
Anyway, I mean, I appreciated what Michael Moore had done in his films, but we wanted to do something. It's sort of so you can do it two ways. So instead of doing it that way, the other way would be something happened that confused our understanding for generations. And
Yes.
I think that, for example, in Elemental, that moment in the film is represented by Dr. Chris Dunn from Oregon State University, where he's talking about how our expectations around what Western landscapes can provide for us in terms of timber, housing, water, they all were in, well, they were a product of an incredible natural resource wealth, a cool, wet climate period, and therefore that led us to believe that we can control wildfire and that the problem is wildfire. And this is Jack Cohen's ultimate thesis and the conclusion of his research and many others, that if we focus on the wildfire as the problem, we will continue to see community conflagration. Versus if we focus on making our communities ignition resistant,
Right.
then we'll experience much less loss. So that's a big shift in the thinking. And I would say one of my favorite books that led me to that space is Media and Apocalypse by Conrad Smith. And Conrad is kind of like an early George Lakoff, if you will, you know, rhetoric framing, how do we think about things?
Right.
And what he does in that book is he goes on his own journey of discovery around how the media and popular culture interprets disasters, starting with the Yellowstone fire. So he was, I think, in Ohio somewhere, and the Yellowstone fire happened, and he heard it was destroyed and burned up, and he loved Yellowstone, and he was heartbroken. 2 years later, he goes out there, and he's like, what the what? Why did they tell me this? It's kind of amazing, you know, why? So he interviews like 450 people, journalists, right? And so one of the things he unpacks is journalists from an urban environment putting an urban lens on the wildlands in their reporting. That's pretty fascinating.
Yeah.
He unpacks and he identifies the Smoky, the effect of Smoky. He calls it the Bambi hypothesis, is another effect of like, what do people remember from Bambi? But he identifies these three dominant cultural beliefs. And, you know, fire kills, destroys the forest, fire kills all wildlife, and fire cannon should be controlled by man, which is either done through suppression or vegetation management. And I think that, of course, fire is paradoxical, right? And we don't want to say that we're going to take certain tools out of the toolbox, but the question isn't that you're pitting various tools against one another. Certain tools, suppression, are appropriate for all the human-caused ignitions on the landscape at the wrong times by fireworks. But they also have their limits, and that's what we're seeing, right? Their limits. And certainly we may be able to push our capabilities. But, you know, when you got a 2,000-foot deep river of wind coming from Canada downslope across Washington State and Oregon, amplified by Typhoon Mesac and the jet stream, then there's limits to what we can do. And so it's really been fun to use the filmmaking to essentially bring the science to life and bring the people that are on the landscape with both traditional knowledge, like the Yurok people and Margot Robbins and Elizabeth Azuz with the Cultural Fire Management Council, and all the scientists, they're acting on the landscape, you know, they're doing the things, and to bring them to life in a way that helps people make some degree of peace with fire is inevitable.
Yep.
And that's what I've been trying to do with film.
That's fascinating. And I'm biased towards your approach, because I've worked in the film industry for 30 years and I know how impactful it is. And, you know, of all of the things people believe about the world about around them, the deepest sets of values are often inculcated by films that they've seen, right?
That, yes.
Right. Whether it was, you know, Schindler's List or, you know, or the Michael Moore stuff, right, on the one side, or you know, things on the more positive side, you know, like what you're doing, that even Einstein talked about, right? How we frame the question determines whether or not we get the right answer. And so if we're only framing the question in terms of how can we portray wildfire in the way that gets the most eyeballs on the news tonight, we're going to take a very different approach than we would if we were trying to actually inform people in a way that could lead them to better decision-making processes. And it looks like that's where you've come.
Yeah. And I continue to go down this road. I mean, we've made with PBS a program called Weathered, which is essentially trying to distill down for everyone what are the dominant factors in various things that we're seeing, you know, polar vortices or these other effects that we're seeing with ocean temperature rising. So basically breaking down weather events to the dominant factors. So you see a lot of after the fire reporting that's Monday morning quarterbacking. And it says, you know, for let's take Lahaina, it's the grasses, legacy of colonial development and sugar plantations and these untended grasses. It's the infrastructure. It's the lack of firefighting. Adequate firefighting response, and so on and so forth. Well, the challenge I find with those things is that That's true almost everywhere. There's always going to be vegetation
Sure.
that's going to be adequate to generate embers that will then arrive in the home ignition zone or adjacent to the structure, ignite some bark mulch or a shrub that then will, you know, find physical pathways to ignite the structure, and then you have structure-to-structure ignition. You know, in California, 80% of home loss is in grasslands and shrublands. It's not a forest problem.
Right.
So there will always be enough vegetation. So for the grasses in Maui, you'd have to be burning those grasses every time you took your kid to soccer practice to stay on top of them. So is that the problem for which there is a solution is what I'm constantly asking myself. And that is the kind of rigor that has come from, you know, standing on the shoulders of Dr. Jack Cohen from the Missoula Fire Lab and others, you know, in his space, whether it's the Insurance Institute for Business or Home Safety or the folks like Daniel Gorham and at the Fire Safety Research Institute and Derek Alconis, both of them who are in the film, is just really looking at those physical pathways and being like, what is the problem we can solve? Because if you say it's not adequate firefighting resources, I mean, you got structure firefighters in bunker gear
dealing with
wildland fire entering into their communities. And when we were in Paradise, you know, visiting with Chico Fire, and now that he's the chief of Yuba City Fire, Jesse Alexander, who does a 3-hour training, an intense emotional, I'm sure, training for a firefighter who is a fire survivor of some of the gnarliest fires in California, about what it was like to deal with the campfire. You know, what we learned was they would have needed every fire truck loaded, gassed, full of water in California, every fire truck from all of California in Paradise in less than an hour to have a chance of saving a third of the homes. You know, so when you realize the enormity of you need 5 to 6 apparatus per structure when you have structures engaged in fire,
yeah,
right? You know, you're like, that's the case everywhere. Most small communities, they don't even have 5 to 6 engines. They have enough for one structure fire, right? So when the Labor Day fires hit Oregon, you know, flames were bent over. The canopies weren't even, there wasn't a rolling crown fire, right? There wasn't a wall of flames entering these communities. It was embers, 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 embers entering the community and igniting bark mulch. I mean, I asked the firefighters there and they were like, yeah, for 2 days we just did evac. And then I was like, well, what did you do the remaining 12, 14 days before they opened it back up? I was in there at like day 8 when it was still engaged in fire. They're like, we went and drove around and put water on bark mulch. That's what we did. And we filled up and then we put water on bark mulch. And that's what kept a number, because Jack says this all the time, the fire moves through the community in like just a couple minutes, the wildland fire does. And then the structures continue to burn. So it's really fascinating to try to really address this. And I think what's wonderful about it is it means there's a lot of hope for Boulder and Lewisville and, you know, other communities in terms of rebuilding. They can make sure it never happens again.
They
by
could.
Focusing very locally. And it's going to require, you know, young people going from lemonade stands to loppers. And it's going to require empowering the fire services to do the assessments, tax credits for homeowners. It's not really, you know, you don't have to change to a metal roof if you got an asphalt roof. You don't have to change the siding. It's like, you know, in relationships, the small stuff matters. And so I'm really committed to filmmaking around helping everyone make sense of the events in the world around them that leads to them to be like, aha, I can take action.
You're the Gottman Institute of fire.
You read Gottman, eh?
Of course I do.
It's been a while since I've read the Gottman books. I mean, I haven't thought about it that way.
It is the little thing, right? It's right. They said he says a marriage isn't a big deal, right? It's 1,000 little deals, and they add up and they make the difference. You know, and you mentioned Boulder. I don't know if you know. I live in Boulder, and from my window, I looked out and I watched the Marshall Fire, and I could actually see Superior, Lewisville, you know, et cetera, from my window, and these pockets of fire as each community caught. And it really, I would describe that fire as a wildfire in which the houses were the trees. And right, and you know, we've just the houses are no longer in tree form, but they're essentially they're tree fuel, which has been actually made more flammable because we divided it into smaller pieces, 2x4s, so that we take the same amount of fuel and we create more surface area to volume ratio, which makes it catch even more easily.
Yes, and exactly, and even worse, homes as fuels are essentially, before they ignite, static petrochemicals, and they burn for considerably longer. And actually, things like OSB strand board, which is basically chipboard with glue, are massive ember generators, far more than anything you'd find in the natural vegetated communities, and they're engaged in fire, in other words, on fire for much longer period, generate far more radiant heat, such that they're, if there's a neighbor with vinyl windows, it melts the perimeter of the vinyl windows, it falls into the house, and then embers get into the house, and you got another structure engaged. So, you see this in the wake of earthquakes in Japan, where you get structures engaged in fire, and then some of them are destroyed or collapsed, and you see community conflagration in the wake of tsunamis and earthquakes. And it's really not a wildfire question. It is a structure-to-structure ignition question. So Jennifer Balk at CU, who I'm sure you know, and others are looking at this question of structure-to-structure ignition, and it's really, in essence, redefining the problem in people's minds, right? The selection and arrangement of these fuels, which are really the dangerous fuels. And what's interesting is, think about hurricane when it makes landfall. A hurricane, when it makes landfall, it loses energy. A fire, when it makes community, when it enters the community, it actually gains energy because it's burning things and consuming those things, and it's building much greater degrees of energy than it would even from burning the boreal or any forest type or any vegetation type, right? The fire coming from the wildlands or adjacent lands, immediately adjacent lands, because for the Marshall Fire, there was, an electrical ignition immediately adjacent to the community. It didn't really
And no
come from.
forest. It was a grassland fire that became a
Yeah, it
structure to
was a
structure
grassland.
fire.
I went to Boulder, and I lived there for 4 years, and I was just there, and I had two close friends that lost their house in the Marshall Fire, and I know other people that I met when I was out there doing a screening of the film at Chautauqua, and at Boulder, and I learned more from the fire services. There was also some folks burning some garbage with some permission immediately adjacent to where my friend lived, so I heard about it from my friend. Before the reports came out, right? There was two ignition sources. But I think, we tend to be like, oh, we want to know what the ignition source was and what the pathways were. And it's like, okay, it's relevant, but again, this,
Yeah,
like you
it's
said,
chasing down
it's
history instead of changing the future.
exactly, Steve. I mean, that's been one of Jack's complaints, for me, is like, he's like, we spend a lot of time trying to figure out the exact pathway of how the fire entered the community versus trying to look at the dominant factor of how we can interrupt that in the future. So he did the reports on Lytton in Canada. He worked on the one for the Fort McMurray fire, Fire 009, and many others, right? But, and including wildland fires where people died. So, that's his message to me is the question that you ask is really important, just like you said. And the problem definition is really important. And Tripp Jennings, who he and Sarah Quinn and I made Elemental, we were sort of the three leads on making Elemental Reimagine Wildfire. He and I went into it starting with a story about forests and fire ecology. And then, we started doing research and we came across Jack. And Jack was like, what happens with vegetation more than 60 feet from the home is irrelevant to whether the home ignites and burns. We were like, what? No way.
What about zone
And
one and zone two and zone three? Yeah, what is that going to do when you have Embercast 40 miles away filling your home with
well,
firebrands?
right, and you're a fire guy, right? So like 90% of homes are ignited by embers, 10% by radiant heat. And that radiant heat is usually that 10% is usually from an adjacent structure. So he did experiments in the Boreal, they're in the film, where they started crown fires and they had these wall sections that were representing houses. And, you know, we now know defensible space, it's rounded up to 100 feet, but he found that more than 30 feet, anything burning, pretty much anything burning more than 30 feet from the home does not generate enough radiant heat to ignite the
Right.
structure. So
Yep.
that's why we say, and he says, you know, don't think of it as a wall of flame entering the community. It's a shower of firebrands or embers that are either coming and they're on fire and then they gather in particular vulnerable places or enter the structure, or they ignite local material, bark mulch, shrubs, in particular juniper and cypress and other arborvitae that burn super hot and
Yeah.
flash at 800 degrees and can crack your windows, or a connected fences. We have extensive footage of connected fences dominoing houses in paradise. So it's just like we were like, okay, wait, that doesn't make sense. So we unpack the two dimensions of the radiant heat component and then the firebrand component. And that's really an aha moment for people because we've just so much oxygen and money has gone to the problem is in the forest. And yes, there's things we might want to do to restore forests, take care of forests, put fire back on the land and forests. However, that's not what we do to keep our houses standing.
Right.
And so it's really important for us to not confound those things, because when we do, as Senator Jeff Golden, who I like to call Senator Wildfire in the state of Oregon, said at one of our screenings, he's like, as long as people think the problem is in the forest, they're not going to do the things to their homes. Right? It's
Absolutely right.
government's problem. It's their problem. I can just chill and go on about my busy life. I mean, people are busy. So, you know, we need to make it clear that there are things. And I think it's pretty empowering because if you think of the things that kids learn about climate change in school, and they're given a project, let's say, Steve, on plastics, do they really have much agency on stopping the global flow of plastics? No, my kid came home pretty mad. One at his school because the reception after they did their projects on plastics, they served them stuff in plastics.
Of
He
course.
thought they were a bunch of hypocrites. The other piece that he was pretty mad about was they're telling us that we have to solve climate change, and he was like, they're the ones who caused it. You caused it, Dad.
Yeah,
And
you
I'm like,
made it, you
well,
fix it, right?
I'm like, actually, we all did, because for any finger we point, there's a couple pointing back at us.
Yep.
You know, and we're all fire people burning the fire to generate our wealth and our comfort. And, you know, so that's been an interesting conversation with him. But if you think about the thing we're talking about, which is home assessments, retrofitting, making
Yep.
your home wildfire prepared, that's it. You know, kids can pick up pine needles. Kids
Right.
can do these
They
jobs.
could replace, you know, bark mulches with whatever, with
They can move the
pebbles,
sh
with rubber mulch, with, you know.
right. They can put
Right.
the river rocks in there. They can make it pretty. They can do those jobs. And I think actually it's been interesting. One of my greatest joys with the film has been middle and high school teachers who have shown the film, and then I come in a week later, a couple days later, and there'll be kids who say, well, I went around my neighborhood or my house and I did an assessment. I was like, what? Yeah, I looked at this. What about this, this, and this? What do I do about that? How do I get our neighbor to do it? You know, what do you think about this? Is there a guide for me? And, you know, so you can see that it really not only like the story of the woman who contacted me who didn't know me at all to ask me to go in her most vulnerable moment, that people are really hungry for what they can do, even in their busy lives.
Yes.
And when it's local and tending to your house and putting a fire code on your house, it's a really, really motivational. So I'm going to keep going with it. I got a bunch of new projects that are, I'd call them moonshots, but then that would put too much stock in that moonshot is the big deal. I'll say they're very challenging, like environmental restoration projects.
Yeah.
They are, one of them's a series for called Fire Safe People that we're working on with actually a team out of Colorado, Steve, that was impacted by the East Troublesome Fire, which is Colorado's fastest moving wildfire. And they're based in Colorado and LA. And I'd love to catch up with you some more about that sometime.
You bet, yeah.
And then other things, just, you know, working with NASA and on some storytelling about bringing traditional ecological knowledge to remote sensing and bringing the power of remote sensing and to amplify reintroducing fire to the landscape and increase the window of opportunity.
I have a question on messaging.
Yeah.
You know, when we teach the, you know, the zones one through whatever, you know, do this 5 feet, do this 10 feet, you know, to what degree is the message science-based versus how is the message shaped by the ease in which the message can be transmitted? Are we telling people what we're telling them because it's the best advice, or are we telling them what we're telling them because that's the easiest message to spread?
Well, two things. I think the message around the home itself, zone zero, like does it have ember-proof vents and does it have junk in the gutters or remove the gutters?
Right.
And does it have a fire-resistant roof? Most of them do. 98% of homes in California do. And then the zero to five, right? The ignition zone.
Yeah.
That's what
That's your radiant area, right?
That's your radiant area where embers can gather and ignite something that then can ignite your siding and get those pathways into igniting the structure. Or that connected fence ignites and then ignites into the structure, right? Because if you like have big beams holding up a porch, those aren't going to ignite from embers. It's got to have something next to it, or like the porch itself, the decking is too tight together and it's got a bunch of fines in there, fine material, and then that ignites. And then
or my gas cans or my propane tanks or whatever.
Right, or your wood pile. That is Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety, and I think a lot of people don't know, Underwriters Laboratory has the Fire Safety Research Institute, where, you know, Derek Alconis and Daniel Gorham work, and I've nerded out on their videos. They're pretty incredible, right? It is there. It shows the pathways.
Yeah.
And then there's the Missoula Fire Lab and all the experiments that Jack did. We even went and found video of stuff that he didn't even know existed anymore. And then he saw the film because we finished it and then showed it to him and lived with whether he liked it or not. And he was just like, oh, my God, where'd you get those interviews? Like, I had no idea that existed. And we was like, yeah, we went into the archives, man, and found that stuff that nobody else had. But so it's research-based. Now, it's a bit confounded and frustrating for homeowners. And that's why there's certain companies that I think are providing software services like FireAside that I'm pretty keen on, that Boulder County has just adopted. Because the founder of that company, he went to get an assessment, he got one, and it was really generic and unhelpful, right? It didn't prioritize for him what to do. It was like, clear defensible space out to 100 feet. He was like, I don't have 100 feet, and are you telling me to cut down all my trees, right? Because there's
or my neighbor's trees because my yard only goes 50 feet. Or
right, and it's actually not the canopy that's the problem, right?
Yeah.
And there's a tension.
It's ladder
right?
fuels,
so,
right?
Well, it is, but the thing is, they're typically, Steve, in an urban environment, again, standing on the shoulders of Jack and others, there aren't often rolling crown fires because the canopy is discontinuous. Many of the communities I've been into after they burned, there's green trees all around and houses destroyed. It's pretty common.
Yeah.
And you see it in Jack's videos, and you see it in Paradise, you see it in the Labor Day fires in Oregon. So you want the trees for shade.
Yeah.
Right? And there's some things on a home design, right, where the roofs are pitched to shed water, but that pitch also means you got a sharp angle that can gather embers, and so that's why you need to cover your venting. It'd be better if it was a 90 and then your eaves were boxed.
Yeah.
But, you know, you do some
they're all rounded like a nice adobe home where it's neither flammable nor angular.
Right, exactly. So it's interesting, like for energy efficiency and fire resistance, they're very simpatico, right? They go very much together. So like in the Labor Day fires, we went into Elkhorn, and the only place we could go get internet and make phone calls was the house that had been made fire resistant. You're talking about a rolling crown fire that came out of the wilderness at 70 miles an hour, and it was consuming everything in its path. intense stand replacement fire, and Mary Bradshaw's house survived. And the insurance adjusters went in there afterwards, and they were like, "Oh my God, you don't even have any smoke damage in here," because she had a heat recovery ventilator. In other words, her house was so tight with no venting, and she had a heat recovery ventilator, which you probably know is a device that does air changes and changes the air from inside the house that's conditioned, in other words, warm, and brings in cold, fresh air and puts the warm into the
Heat
cold coming
transfer.
in, does the heat transfer, but it keeps the house super tight. And she had no venting. She had an unvented roof, and she had a slab on grade house. So there's a lot of things you can do with construction, with new construction, that are energy efficient and fire resistant. But then there's some things where there's a tension. Again, your trees, you don't want heat islands and all. You want the trees. You want the tree canopy, right? We need
Sure.
that, particularly more and more. But people immediately go to the trees because they think of that wall of flames. But actually, the thing that's really a threat in their community is all the juniper and cypress that will
Oh,
burn at
yeah.
800. They
That'll go like
flash.
crazy.
They're basically firebombs
Yeah, it's
that the fire
oil. It's
safety.
all that oil with lots of surface area and some wood in there too, just to keep it going once the oils catch.
Totally. And Fire Safety Research Institute has videos of juniper and cypress torching and cracking windows because they generate a
Oh,
flash of
yeah.
800 degrees. So if you have those within less than 30 feet, that's a super danger, even if you've done all the home ignition zones. So it's not purely 0 to 5, it's out to 30, but only certain things out to 30. So it's not
Right.
like a denuded, prison perimeter that's unattractive. But I'll say, I got super, deep into this world and talk about it at home, not all the time over the dinner table, but some.
Most of the time.
Some of the time, my son was complaining to me on the way to school today because I asked him if we could listen to a podcast. He was like, "Is it on fire? That's all you talk about for the last 7 years, Dad." I'm like, "Okay, we'll listen to your music and I'll
How
listen
old is
to
your
it on the
son?
way home." He's 13. So anyway, we were, talking about this all the time. My wife was like, "Well, are we going to do it to our house?" And it was really hard for me because I love our red osier dogwood shrubbery around the house that gives privacy. But what we've done is actually quite visually attractive, and now I feel good about it. And it's interesting hearing the top man from the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety, Roy Wright, say what is the number one thing that he felt was going to be the hardest for people to do. And mind you, Royce grew up in Paradise. He's from Paradise. And he's at this conference called the Wildfire Resistant Homes Conference that was the first inaugural one around the time we released the film. And we attended and shown our film, and I attended all the sessions. It was awesome for me that to find and discover the stuff that we put in the film, that there was all these people, that's all they spend time on. And I didn't really know how many people were really spending time on it when we completed it. We knew something, but we didn't know the depth of it. And Roy says in his presentation, the number one thing is going to be getting people to move their shrubbery away from their homes. Right? And so it's an emotional thing. So I think
Yeah.
the other answer to your question is, who's the decision maker in the house? How do you reach the decision maker in the house with empathy for the decision that they're making? And you're asking them to do something that's not like a kitchen reno or a bathroom renovation, right? That they it's a thing that affects the aesthetics
Yep.
and plants that they're attached to. And so it's an emotional decision. And for, a possibility that seems less and less remote, so you have to figure out how to communicate that. And I think the best people out there that are doing that, that are in communities where, like Tahoe, I don't know if you know this, Steve, they're on a 3-year rotation. They assess every house once every 3 years, and 74% of the people
Wow.
are taking the actions. Like, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Malibu is getting there.
Okay.
Marin is getting there. Boulder is serious about it. Aspen is serious about it and have been. They're on a 5-year, once every 5-year rotation in Aspen. The chief there is totally on it, gets it, and Allie. who's the lead, Allie Hammond, Hager Hammond, is totally on it, right? So they're trying to think about not just approaching people with the technical piece, but if you say, oh, it's defensible space out to 100 feet, people feel overwhelmed. They're like, you're asking me to cut down everything. Is that what you're asking me to do? And I don't know, have you ever done some vegetation work or made burn piles? It's a lot of
Yeah,
work.
sure. Yeah.
So
I bought a backhoe to make it a little easier. You
where
should
do
see
you
how quickly you can move juniper with that thing.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I was thinking today on the way home from my kid, I was like, we should start the Society for the Eradication of Flammable Torches, and that's really for the eradication of juniper and cypress
Yeah,
in our
well, that's
communities.
big
Something fun,
in
right? Something
Texas.
fun to like that
So, you know,
just.
so I was thinking, you know, the way to get anything done, right, is to create that economic incentive, right? So you create a market for juniper oil, right? And if you can sell juniper oil or cedar oil, you know, for, you know, $100 a quart, now all of a sudden people will harvest them and press them like they do grapes.
Yeah, I wonder, you know, so I've been talking to, I just got a message this morning from somebody who's got a biochar facility, and we met recently and did a presentation, and I think the lightning in the bottle would be restoring soils. How do we take those materials that are in urban environments that we have too much of that are posing a danger to our structures and convert them into environmental restoration? Without too much trucking, right? Without
Yeah,
too much
right.
energy inputs to do them, because there's these other things that I find preposterous or highly questionable might be the right word, relating to carbon capture and storage and injecting slurries of carbon deep into the earth to have permanent carbon storage. I mean, seriously,
It's amazing what they can get funding for research for the most inane, impractical, high expensive stuff. I mean, people are just they're reaching for that crazy thing when the obvious solution is usually obvious, inexpensive, and accessible.
Right, and that's where I go to my thing. Like I did a review with the Institute of Global Environmental Strategies and in collaboration with NASA of like 200 tech companies in the fire tech space, which was just this thing that happened as a result of making this film and getting pulled into that and having a lot of contacts in the science space. And it was pretty fascinating, right, to see the companies that I felt, based again on the people that I'm standing on the shoulders of, had a good problem definition and a good solution, and the ones that had things that I thought were either amplifying the wildfire paradox, possibly, or would require massive energy inputs that would almost obviously the writing on the wall was that they would cancel out any
Yeah,
potential
right.
benefit. So I'm like, that's why I'm like big on like saying, okay, yeah, let's not call it a moonshot. Let's call it the real hard thing to do, which is
Yes, right.
environmental restoration. And I like your idea of something local for the use of that. And my mind goes to rebuilding the fundamental resource of soils,
Yep.
partly because my wife and I are involved in a farm. And we know how hard it is to farm, and we know how fundamental from trying to grow cherries and pears the soil is.
Yeah.
And from our relationships with the farming community. So I'm like thinking that's the lightning in the bottle we should pursue versus these schemes that we don't have time and money
You're going to pump the
growing.
CO2 into rocks under ocean. Come on.
I can't imagine that it'll pencil in a positive way.
Yeah, right.
I could be wrong. I could learn. But anyway, so
Probably
that's
not.
kind of where my head is at and things I'm working on. I do, have a background, Steve, as well in environmental law. I did years ago work for the largest reinsurance company in the world in Munich for the Munich
Munich
Re.
Re? Yeah, I'm speaking to them now.
You're going to speak to somebody from the Munich Re. I'll have to listen to that
yeah,
one. I'd be interested.
Yeah, so I'm speaking to them, not just on the podcast, but also, so you know, Team Wildfire is based on a premise. You know, our technology is based on a couple of premises. The biggest one is that the major influence on a fire spread is wind, and until you're addressing the wind, you're messing around. And just like they say, you're going to fight fire with fire, put good fire on the ground. You're going to fight wind with wind. And so our principal technology is not based about stopping wildfires. You know, they need to burn. It's about protecting insured values at risk. Nobody can say they can stop, you know, 1,000 miles of fire line, you know, but can we stop the fire from burning down the nuclear power plant or the hospital? That I think we can do by putting jet engines onto trucks and literally pushing back, reversing the dominant wind direction in that microclimate that we're trying to protect. That if we inject retardants into jet exhaust at 300 miles an hour, we can turn back fire around the nuclear power plant, around the hospital, around the school, and the fire will go around it. And not lose that asset. So that's what we're speaking with Munich Re about, is that, you know, if you're insuring a nuclear power plant, you know, you're at risk of writing a multi-billion-dollar check if something happens to that plant. So you will invest, you know, if it's 50 or 100 million bucks to stop that thing from burning, mm-hmm. It's cheap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I checked it out. I'm interested to see how that works out. You know, of course, when you got a 2,000-foot deep river of wind, I appreciate it.
Yeah, you're not going to have huge impact.
I appreciate,
but you could also get out in front of it, because the reach of that giant spray can is about 600 feet. So if you want to go out there and do periodic, you know, fire barrier mitigation, if you want to leave those attractive vegetation, you know, sources around the place, but you don't want it to burn, you could go out there every month, every 6 weeks, and lay, you know, a neutral impact fire barrier gels or retardants that make the vegetation more fire resistant. So you can leave it in place, but it won't conduct fire at the speed of untreated vegetation.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I appreciate that you are identifying the scope of what the solution can address. And I think that there's not enough of that as folks are promoting, maybe getting in on the gold rush of fire tech a bit. There are a number of people that are really authentically, properly defining the problem and trying to not go fast, but really do something that is accurate and builds trust. I think we need a lot of that. We need those kinds of people in this space. The reason I mentioned the insurance industry is I was just going to share with your listeners that, that piece of my background was, I mean, I was young. I was out of college, and I worked in Munich for about a year as a work study at the Munich Re. Learned German. I'm Dutch. So I have a Dutch and American nationality, and then I worked in London. My father was a broker at Lloyd's, a name at Lloyd's, and so I kind of understood reinsurance from him, insuring insurance and global risk. And I think there's, you know, it's been really interesting coming back into that world, going to the Casualty Actuarial Society of America, listening to what's primary for them, and the things that, you know, Jack and IBHS and NFPA, National Fire Protection Association, have identified as primary. That's what the insurance industry cares about. And so we really tried to bring that to life in an episode of PBS Weathered that features Nancy Watkins from Milliman, who is Milliman's an insurance consultancy that advises insurance and reinsurance. Roy Wright from IBHS is in there. And then the next episode that we're working on gets into what you're talking about. What we're seeing, the dominant factor in communities that are burning is these are wind events with fire in them. And whether it's a synoptic wind event, in other words, a downslope wind event coming from Canada east from the east into Oregon, which is what we get down the Columbia drainage, or a local high pressure, I don't know if the right word is collapsing, but pushing down on the Rockies, right, goes up on the one side on the Wasatch and then comes down the other side. The amount of those the drying force of those winds as they move downslope is fascinating. So we're making an episode for PBS Weathered about wind events with fire in them, which is common to all the destructive fires, Lahaina, Marshall, Tubbs in Santa Rosa, Carr in Redding, the East 2020 Labor Day fires, the recent ones in Eastern Washington that got ignored because they were in the wake of the Lahaina fires but burned 750 homes. You know, it's the common factor, right? And
Right.
so I think that's really interesting, you know, that this is how the insurance industry looks at it. They get it. I am not sure they're very clearly in all cases articulating how we can deploy federal and state resources in the most effective and durable manner, and that they're willing to engage in that as much as I would think that they could benefit from doing that. But I think that with insurance exiting significant parts of California, and it's starting to happen in Oregon and Colorado and other western states, I mean they kind of have to if they
Yeah,
want to stay in those markets.
they kind of have to do it more selectively, I think. There are companies like Athena in California that are being able to go kind of block by block and say, like, yeah, you might want to consider not insuring this guy, but there's no reason you shouldn't continue collecting premiums from that neighborhood because that neighborhood, has got mitigation or has got natural features around it that make it much lower risk. So to say we're going to exit the California market, is really, I think, oversimplifying and denying them revenue opportunities where there's actually not risk everywhere. Some places might be at 95% risk. Some places might only be at 5% risk. So to take that blanket approach, I think is really the insurance companies are kind of selling themselves short there.
Yeah, and it's a function. I mean, you've learned this from the Munich Re, though. It's a function of there not being enough reinsurance cover, insurance for insurance, and what their global appetite or capacity is for insuring those losses. And I think a lot of folks think, well, can't we just get the government to tell them they have to? No,
No.
we can't. So, you know, it's interesting that California just legislators just introduced a bill to give everyone up to a $10,000 credit for doing the things. I think that's another
Yay.
thing that is going to deal with the social dimensions around the
Yep.
decision making, because you don't doing the things for your home doesn't result in equivalent reduction in premiums, but doing the things for your homes collectively will mean that you can stabilize eventually the insurance market, I think.
Yeah.
I think there's also larger forces at play, from what I understand, of sort of a global retrenchment of the reinsurance industry. So anyway, it's just to share with you that I'm really trying to, in the storytelling, understand these larger forces, keep learning as I go, and think about how we reach people with that information. Because, you know, a post-screening of Elemental, we've done 250, maybe 300 shows nationwide and 45 festivals. People will ask questions like, oh, so I need to get a metal roof. And I'm like, well, do you have an asphalt roof? They're like, yeah. I'm like, oh, it's already a Class A roof. Like, you don't need to
Right.
spend that. And again, you know, the whole little things
If
that
you want to do
matters.
rainwater collection, you might prefer metal, so you're not adding, the petroleums into your water supply, but
Right,
for fire,
totally.
maybe not. Yeah.
For fire, maybe not. And then, like, it's just that, like, the other one is people like, oh, well, 7 out of 20 of the most destructive fires in California were power line ignited. Let's bury all the lines. And I'm like, well, I appreciate that. Maybe it would have been good if we did that from the start.
Right, the
It would
carbon
be really.
footprint of mitigating that now would be worse than the fires, probably.
Well, the cost, let's take, I mean, it's interesting. Again, it all comes down to this proper problem definition and what's the scope of your solution again and again and again. Because if you're talking in California in high risk areas, there's 40,000 miles of uninsulated lines.
Yeah, right.
It's 1 million at the low end to a high end of at least 3 million per mile to
Yeah.
just switch those to insulated lines. And so, you know, I have spent a lot of time on the utility question in Oregon because I had a former alcohol, tobacco, firearms, fire investigator, arson investigator who did, 600 arson investigations over a 25-year career. He and I did sort of an informal but impactful investigation into the causes of the Labor Day fires. And we went around and gathered evidence.
And this is not an anti-union or pro-union stance, right? It just happened to happen on Labor Day.
It just happened on Labor Day. I mean, we typically get east wind events in the winter. We just had one. We knocked a bunch of trees, knocked a power, crushed a bunch of houses. 12-plus people died from falling trees. But when we get them in September, right, they're dry east wind downslope events. That's what we get. We get big multi-state synoptic, meaning across a region, wind events that are essentially rivers of wind. Yeah, it happened on Labor Day. It happened on Labor Day in 2017. We got the Eagle Creek fire, and it happened on Labor Day 2020. We got the multiple fires across the state, and 1 million acres burned and 5,000 homes burned up. And then we got it again when we released the film on Labor Day 2022, and we had red flag warnings and smoke events, and people were on generators right when we were releasing the film, and it was very triggering for fire survivor communities, yet they still came to see the film. But anyway, so it's a common thing that we get around that time. But no, it's not an anti-labor thing. But the union, and I appreciate the levity there, the power line thing is just like, that's $120 billion just to bury 40,000 right. miles of line. The answer is public safety power shutoffs and to some degree some vegetation management, but even doing vegetation management on those lines yeah. is not the solution because there will still be fine material below them
right.
if the lines hit the ground that can ignite. Right. And so
$120 billion, they could build everyone a new fire safe house.
It's those choices. Exactly, Steve. It's so, and I don't want to make it too much of a zero sum game, but I also get, I don't know if the right word is irritated question when someone says, well, don't take any of the tools out of the toolbox. we need all of the above strategies. Okay. But what we also need is using the tools in what degree and what measure that are durable and effective over space and time. And right now, or historically, a lot of money and oxygen has gone to certain tools. Because if we yeah. look at the budget in California, let's say, which is one of the biggest states in the nation and globally that spends money on wildfire, leaving aside fire suppression, less than 2% of the budget goes to the home and community mitigation. It goes to things that have been shown to be ineffective in the Dixie Fire and many other fires. Fire
breaks. The question is really whether they're effective in fire mitigation and remediation or whether they're effective in getting elected. And unfortunately, like response gets you elected and prevention just shows that you're a wasteful spender in the eyes of, politicians. So people want to do the thing that they get the credit for, not the thing that's most important, unfortunately, based on our 4-year cycles of wisdom, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, the air show is a little bit more appealing, right? But
right.
they spent 620 million plus and 6,000 firefighters and had massive amounts of aircraft, yet the Dixie Fire burned for 100 plus days. And it was eventually the weather that right. turned the tide.
Ditto so here, right? In the Boulder Fire, it wasn't until, in the Marshall Fire, it wasn't until the snow fell that the fires went out. And even highly experienced, aerial firefighters like Dan Reese, he said you could blanket the sky with aluminum wings and you're not going to put out the fire until you have the boots on the ground work.
Yep, exactly. And I think that the fire services, both the structural fire and the wildland fire folks, are under so much pressure. And I've seen this time and again, and we really tried to represent how they're holding themselves and the work that they're doing on behalf of the community and how much risk they're taking. and show that with empathy while at the same time communicate the limits. And that's been one of the other biggest compliments we've gotten around the film is thank you, Ralph, thank you, Trip, for making a film that tells the public the limits of what we're able to do, because that is so hard for us to convey. And in those private moments after the film, when the fire services folks have been on panels or in the audience and they come up and no one else is around and they tell their stories that they typically only share maybe with their colleagues, that's been really incredible and gratifying to be able to say, like, yes, you do everything you can operationally, but your number one is not to die. And that this piece about limits, because again, it's similar, like, going back to Conrad's book, if folks think that firefighters can be everywhere all at once, putting wet stuff on the red stuff and keep their bacon from getting crispy, then, and they can say, oh, we support our firefighters. Well, let's all collectively support firefighters before fire comes to make it,
And you're right. You spend a lot less time on the tightrope when you know there's no net underneath you, and you do a lot less stuff in the wooey when you realize that there's not a bazillion firefighters to come put out every fire. Right? When we know, hey, it's very limited resources, they're stretched more and more thinly, and to act as if you can go do the things that are likely to cause fires. With this false belief that there's this invincible fire force there to get to cover your back, is bad thinking. When you realize that the fire that you start might take out 100 homes before the weather puts it out, you think twice about burning your trash. And this idea like, oh, the Iron Dome of firefighting, is ever present to protect me. It's not so. And people lose their homes and their lives because of that errant thinking.
Yeah, I really appreciate you saying that, Steve, and that's I am heartened when I speak to other people that are in this space that are, presenting that paradox and that nuance and that complexity while also saying there are solutions that we can achieve. Because I think that that's a big part of fire is embracing that paradox, and then making the hard choices about what we do with all the choices and tools that we have and where they're effective. And that's kind of my core guiding thing and guided towards getting all hands on deck, right? And not in getting everyone on deck in a shaming, finger-pointing way, but getting them to have those moments of like, there's something that I can do, and it matters, and it's neighbor to neighbor, and it's relational, and I can have that awareness about when I play with fireworks and when I burn some trash and when I burn some debris piles, and have a campfire and be mindful of those kinds of things, and that knowing those things can actually allow me to be more chill.
Yeah, that's right.
So
Let me ask you
anyway.
about one more bit of technology that, we talked about the gold rush of wildfire. And then I'll let you go because we've been here an hour, and what we'll do is we'll just reconvene, in a few days to continue the conversation. But rightly or wrongly, one of the things I've made fun of is this rush towards cameras, sensors, and satellites. As if the problem was that we didn't know that a fire had started, or as if, more sensory input, mechanical perception input, is what was lacking in our ability to control fires that threaten values at risk. I say, I've never seen a wildland firefighter running away from a out of control blaze yelling, "Get me some more sensors." why are we seeing, you know, where's the value? And if we're spotting fires that our policies are telling us to leave alone, then isn't really policy more important than technology? And community development, where do you fall on that? Or is it more complex?
I think you're asking the right questions, right? I mean, there's companies like Pano AI that are deployed in Washington State, and then there's another one that's deployed in Oregon. It's not Pano AI, that's open source. I think to some degree, it gives us some more situational awareness. And then there's another company called Dryad that has these things that they're putting in trees.
Sensors.
The mesh sensors that can smell
smoke. N5 with similar technology.
Right, the Internet of Things, IoT, and I'm familiar with many of those because they were part of the review, and I've met to some degree some of the founders of those companies or the people that are involved in them. I mean, I think that there's the question, are they going to be deployed to put out foolish human-caused ignitions around the 4th of July quicker so that then we're not, you know, having to spend $5 million, $10 million, $20 million to deal with a firework fire, that's probably okay, right? If it amplifies our ability to deal with 9 out of 10 fires that are started by humans at the wrong time, wrong place in communities, then if it amplifies our ability to deal with suppression of the fires that we don't want, don't need, wrong time, wrong place, okay. But if it means that we're going to go put out small fires in wildlands and, you know, tamp down the potential for beneficial fire that do work much cheaper than anything else and with less damage in terms of carbon loss and everything else, soils, than mechanically doing it on steep slopes, then, you know, then it's amplifying the wildfire paradox.
Right.
You're asking, I think, absolutely the right questions, and you've seen some degree of pivot from some of those companies, I think, or at least I have started to see a bit of pivot that maybe those applications have some utility in beneficial fire as well. And I think that there's folks in those spaces and in the funding of those kinds of companies or in those companies that are asking the same questions that you are, Steve. So that's a good thing. I do see a lot of things in that space that I like, and I see a lot of things that I have questions about. For example, one that really irks the scientists that I know that are in the top 1% of most cited scientists in the space of global climate change and carbon storage over space and time, carbon and forests, is this comparison between the release of carbon from forests to the release of carbon from cars. Okay? They are not the same, right? Everyone knows that cars do not uptake carbon and that cars release below ground carbon that is 4 million years old.
And when a car dies, it's not going to reabsorb the carbon as it turns itself into a fledgling new car.
No, exactly.
Right?
And forests, on the other hand, are in a global state of carbon flux over space and time. And it's the total
mass. Yeah, they turn
mass
carbon into trees.
Right. And it's in other vegetation and soil. So it's the total mass balance over space and time. And if you're saying, oh, well, these fires released as much carbon as, or more carbon than California managed to save over the last decade. Well, California didn't do enough. I mean, that's what that tells me. It doesn't tell me that forests are bad and fire is bad and high severity fire is maligned as being bad. I mean, high severity fire is part of the landscape. There was this mind-blowing presentation at the Association for Fire Ecology about Pyrus cumulonimbus clouds by Mark Castano from the Catalan, Spain fire services about high severity fire and dense forests may have evolved to resist high severity fire and the wind in them. You would really dig it since you're into the wind thing and keyed into the wind thing. I'll send you the link to it. And I met with him after the presentation to talk with him more about it. And NASA's looking at Pyrus EBs as well and some of their remote sensing. And they're described in John Valiant's most excellent fire weather book.
Yeah.
And I just think that, like, we have to really think about the metaphors we're using, and are those metaphors amplifying the challenges we face of getting people to live with fire? Again, are they the right definition of the problem? I mean, forests are going to be releasing and uptaking carbon. That's what they do. And it's the pulse is not what matters. It's the total mass balance over space and time, right? And there's studies that are pretty hopeful from the Oregon Cascades, where you had a burned and unlogged, a burned and logged, and an unburned. And the burned and unlogged had the same amount of carbon as the unburned old growth within 15 years that had regained it. So if you focus on the pulse from the fire, you're boogeymanning, you know, the thing that is not relevant. And so it's just interesting how just in the fire tech space, there are certain individuals that use the narrative of carbon release and they're boogeymanning the forests, but they're not really looking at all the fire inputs.
Yeah. And in many cases, it's not the carbon, it's the soot. You know, carbon goes out and carbon comes back, right? But releasing a lot of soot at once, you know, creates a medium in the atmosphere that can be readily heated by the sun and cause more warming.
Right.
A lot of ways to look at it, right?
And of course, you know, I have to recognize that fire smoke kills more people and causes more hospitalizations than itself. It's a huge issue. We have to deal with it, particularly for people working outside that are working on our food systems and bringing in crops and the overlap between those events of fire and smoke events. I mean, these have chronic health impacts. I'm not trying to downplay that by any means. I just think that the choices that we make on how we convey, those of us in the space that are supposed to be deep in it, I would like more thoughtfulness around it. Just like you're trying to encourage with your questions and your podcast. So thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Ralph. Boy, yeah, I described last summer's experience as, you know, Canada's inability to keep its smoke to itself.
Well, apparently a number of those fires are still burning in the peat bogs.
Yes, they are, and they'll continue burning.
They're starting to flare up.
Have a few thousand firefighters for an area that size, you know, you're very limited in what your response capabilities are. Ralph, my dad was a food reporter on PBS and CNN. His name is Bert Wolf. And I remember he had a sign stuck to his cork board that I saw in his office every afternoon. And it said, a reporter, or in this case, a filmmaker, but he was a reporter. It said, a reporter is someone who conducts their education in public. And I love how you've used your filmmaking talents not only to inform the public and frame questions in a way that allow better answers, but to really learn this topic yourself by gaining access to the tall shoulders, you know, that have come before you and then building on that. And I think that's just a magnificent way to go about a career.
Thanks. I'm super enjoying it.
It's really fascinating.
It's fun to continually be learning and challenging. And I will say for your listeners, if they've hung on this long, that, you know, I recently read John Valiant's book, and I was always a fan of the Golden Spruce. I love biogeography, human development, politics, biology, evolution type books, whether it's like Krakatoa, which I think is a fantastic book because of where it gets into, like, how do we figure out plate tectonics and why the animals and plants on one side of the Wallace line are different than they are on the other in the Ring of Fire in Indonesia, why the Dutch were kicked out, you know, why Albert Bierstadt has his beautiful landscape paintings because there was a big volcanic plume that turned the sunsets pink. You know, it's just fascinating stuff. And Valiant did an amazing job with the Golden Spruce about Queen Charlotte Islands and Haida Gwaii and all that history. And then I think he did a fantastic job with Fire Weather, and for me it was personally and professionally transformative to read his book and to just hear some of the things that they had to do in Fort McMurray to interrupt the sequence of loss was just mind-boggling. But it also crystallized some of the things that were in my own head. And it's been that way when I went to the Insurance Casualty Actuarial Society meeting, they were like, would you come and screen your film? We'll pay for you to come down. I said, yeah, and I'd like to come and attend all the sessions. They were like, what? I was like, yeah, I want to attend all the sessions. And, you know, I know actuaries aren't really the most personable bunch, you know. But I sort of made some jokes my dad told me from the insurance world. But I like that learning aspect. And I think it's important for those of us who have invested careers in doing a certain thing to be willing to say, well, maybe that's not the right thing to do anymore, because we're seeing a stepwise progression. We're seeing, right. seeing what we just saw in Valparaiso and Viña del Mar and Chile. We're seeing these things show up. Like Marshall, that wasn't mapped as high risk. I mean,
nor was it during fire season, right? And you know, and then I hate the losses that happened there, but I appreciated that it broke the notion that there's a fire season, right? That every day is fire season now. It's a fire year, just like a fiscal year, and in terms of alertness of when to be ready to respond, you know, it's year round now.
Yeah, totally, man. And I think that that's about like, I go back to the metaphor that I use a lot with growing up in Holland with my dad. He'd take me out in the North Sea and I was so scared. And we were in little sailboats, very small for the waves. And I'd try to go down below and read the maps and think that that was safer. And it was diesely and gnarly. And I learned that it was better to be up on the deck and looking at the horizon line and engaged with the material and engaged with the environment. And then I felt better. And I think I think that that's the case with all these things around extreme weather, and people want to have a desire to have to make sense of it. And then I think that there's a lot of people that are trying to bring those solutions and help folks make sense of it.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, so I mean, that's the core of what we need to do.
Yeah, I was going to say on your book list, you know, don't read Sapiens in that case, because it'll simply show you that everywhere humans have gone, we've screwed it all up, from extinctions to wildfire. Like, yeah. We might heal some things, but on the whole, like, the Earth would be better without us.
Yeah, so I mean, there are those Hobbesian views, and I struggle with that. I mean, I think that there's a lot more research showing that in, these are narratives that lead us to certain political decisions around incarceration or whatever it is, right? And they have those fundamental roots. That's why I'm very interested in those kinds of things. But I think that Hobbesian view of the world of everything's nasty, brutish, and short, and we're all out for ourselves. Is that true or is that not true? Because I think you see far more evidence of people collaborating in the face of disaster and helping each other out. But that's just not the narrative that seems to be dominant in the media around that.
Right, right. That's true. You see all the footage of the looters taking advantage, but you don't see a lot of stories about neighbors helping neighbors, which is the predominant activity.
Yeah. Trip Jennings, for PBS Weather, he did an episode and he did the research, and there's a lot more evidence of people cooperating and working together than there is people being out for themselves. And ultimately, we're so connected that that's where we need to head. But of course, globally, we see lots of things happening that are very hard to see, that are the opposite of that. So, anyway, I might still read Sapiens anyway.
Okay. It's a great book. It really is.
Super fun to visit with you. I look forward to another time.
And, absolutely, Ralph. Thanks so much, and stick around for a second. Thanks so much for joining me on the Fire Break. As you know, the Fire Break is sponsored by Team Wildfire, developing new techniques and technologies for dealing with the world's most dangerous fires. Ralph, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. Everyone needs to go see Elemental. And what's the link? Where can people find it?
It's elementalfilm.com. It's Elemental Reimagine Wildfire. It's on Amazon, Apple TV, Google Play, Vimeo Plus. If you're in a university or school, you can get it through Canopy. You can get an institutional license. And you can also buy a Blu-ray or DVD. If your kid has a video game console, you can still use, not so old school that it can't be used anymore. And we're also working on curriculum for teachers for 6th through 12th grade. So yeah, it's available through all the things, and you can find it at elementalfilm.com.
Thank you, Ralph. And I think you're showing that what you do for people here has far more impact than what, you know, the tools that you put in their hands, and just culturally, individually. So thank you so much for the contributions that you've made.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to The Firebreak. I'm Steve Wolf. Take care, and we'll see you at the next one.